Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Porto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF FM in Palmer, Alaska, 89.5. You can also hear us on our web feed at radiofreepalmer.org. And following the broadcast every week, we are on mushingradio.com, where you can find a full broadcast of all of our archive shows. So make sure you check that out. Tonight, we are continuing our Iditarod musher coverage, and we have on the line Jerry Souza, calling in from Talkeetna, Alaska. Jerry, how's it going this evening?
It's going real well. We got nice cool temperatures today.
It is an absolutely beautiful day here in the Matsu Valley. How is it up there in Talkeetna? I hear that that's the gateway to Mount McKinley. Can you tell us a little bit about where you live up there?
Yes, we live just off the north end of the runway, off of 36. And right now, a lot of the mountain climbers are coming into Talkeetna and being flown up for their lifetime dream of climbing Denali there.
Yeah, and you know, it's an absolutely beautiful spot up there. We went up there just last fall for our first time. We've only been in Alaska for about a year and a half now, and I love that little town. It's got a little bit of a Colorado feel to it, I think.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah, it's a pretty nice place, all right. Yep.
So you are a Iditarod musher that hails from California. You've made it your way up here in the early 70s, and then, of course, you trained and are running the Iditarod, I believe, since 2000. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think this is our 11th Iditarod. We've completed 10.
Not a bad start, then, if you're only doing it since 2000. If I could ask, how did you get started into the sport of dog sledding? Was it, you know, a childhood fascination? You know, a lot of us read the stories from Jack London, that sort of thing, and the next thing you know, we're packing up the U-Haul and moving our way up here. How did you get started?
Well, it was a childhood fascination. I can remember as a little boy in California and taking my neighbor's dog for a run with a collar, and they're dragging me around on the bicycle, and I couldn't hardly stop it. You know, it was a standard boxer, I believe is what it was, a tan boxer, an old dog, but that guy would just jerk me all over the neighborhood. It was pretty fun. And then that kind of went away, and I came to Alaska and as a young boy after that, and forgot about mushing for quite a few years, and met Kathleen Holden. She was a sprint musher, retired from sprint mushing, but had a group of dogs, and that dream kind of rekindled about running the last great race, the Iditarod, and here we are today.
And you've done a little bit of everything up here in Alaska. You're a pilot. You've done hunting, guiding, and I'm sure you've done your fair share of fishing. But before we get into this mushing thing, I definitely want to talk to you about being a pilot. You know, everybody here in Alaska seems to be a pilot or have a plane or, you know, fly all around, and that's kind of the second form of transportation, I guess, here, at least in most of Alaska. Tell us a little bit about that, Jerry.
Well, Alaska is an absolutely gorgeous state to fly in, because you can just go cross country hour after hour and just look at all the landscape that Alaska has to offer. So in that respect, I think it's probably one of the best places in the world to fly.
Can you tell us a little bit about your plane? Do you still own a plane? Or I know we talked a little bit off air there, and you know, tell us a little bit about that, flying in one of those, you know, small little planes. A lot of people haven't experienced anything like that.
Well, the small little plane, what I have is, of course, by Alaska standards, considered pretty much the ultimate. It's a Piper Super Cub, 160 horse. I've got large Tundra tires for it. They're now up to 35 inches, so you can. It's like a, basically like a three-wheeler with wings. You can take off and land just about anywhere there isn't a large obstacle to have to get over. So out west was typically the primary place I flew. It was just vast miles and miles of tundra, and we would hunt caribou and moose out in that area. And then I was also did quite a bit of herring spotting back in the good old days, I suppose, where you could fly with a 100 other pilots in circles looking for the herring and try to avoid running into each other. That was always quite exciting as well. But the thing, I guess, it was a challenge. Flying, of course, was always the weather factor. We get caught in a lot of weather, it seems, at times. And with the Super Cub, you just pull the power back, get kind of close to the ground, pull a notch of flaps, and slow it down to about 70 miles an hour and kind of get through it. What I always liked to do when I was out there is, of course, get across the Alaska Range is a big obstacle. So you fly through there on the good weather, and then when we're in our area, so to speak, a 100-mile radius or so or a little bit further, we kind of get to know the lay of the land and can basically go IFR, which is, in our terms of VFR pilots, is I follow rivers, I follow roads, you know, kind of thing, and to get back to base. And so we're always on the edge of the envelope of the weather because we were working with the planes. And when you're working them, it's a little bit different than flying for fun, you know.
Right, right. How much do you think that varies from, you know, being a pilot in the military or, you know, commercial pilot? You guys, I guess they call you guys bush pilots. You know, you guys are a rare breed, you know. And my only experience, of course, is watching that show on the Discovery Channel. So I don't have a heck of a lot of experience. But you guys seem like, man, you've really got it going on up there.
Well, yeah, like I said, I'm not flying too much anymore since I became a dog musher. I simply don't have the time. But the bush pilots up here, they're kind of a step above of what I was doing, and they're a little bit more commercialized. They have a little larger aircraft ranging from four passengers, six passengers, up to, I think, I don't know, a dozen passengers for doing scenic tours around Denali and Denali National Park. But it's quite a thrill to take a scenic flight and fly along with one of those pilots. They're all very seasoned, very professional, and it's just, there's just nothing like it on Earth to get into a plane and get right up front and close to the mountain Denali, huh?
Very cool, very cool. So let's transition to that dog sledding fixation that we all have. And you know, it, like you said, it does take up all of our time. Tell us a little bit about your kennel and what you have set up there in Talkeetna.
Well, what we have is about 60, 65 dogs now, We, of course, have some older retired veterans from the early Iditarods. They're still with us. We have a lot of young dogs coming up in the yearling age group. And then the primary kennel of 24 or so dogs is around the there'll be about four coming up this next year. So four, five, six. It's kind of the peak of the age for the racing dog. And we're just kind of getting right up into speed with this with the stock of dogs that we have here. And then we do give rides in the summer to help pay for our habit of mushing in the winter. As everybody knows, it's almost a prohibitively expensive sport, especially when you get into the aspect of competition. You know, we feed just absolute the best dog food we can find and try to give the best care for the dogs, and seems no expense is spared on taking care of them.
Well, with Talkeetna being the pretty much that gateway to Denali, I'm sure that there's quite a bit of the tour bus crowd that heads up your way. How do you entertain those folks that come from the lower 48, sometimes from Europe and other countries that have that fascination of you know, watching dog mushing, whether it be in the movies or on TV or reading those books like Jack London? What do you tell these folks that have never done this before?
Well, first thing we do is to give them a first-hand experience. We take them for a ride, and we, of course, bring them up to the line. And, of course, with sled dogs, you can't really have them heel on a leash to get to the hookup, so it's rather counterproductive to try to train heel, and then you want them to run. So we end up having to hold them up by the neck, so to speak, with the collar, because they're hopping around. It's like I say, you got to take the four-wheel drive or four-wheel paw away, and then the handler, and we can handle the dogs a lot better. So we'll kind of put our arm around them and cuddle them, cradle them, so to speak, so they're jumping up and down but don't have the full power. We'll hook them up into the line and load the people up in the cart, and we take off for a run, and they just absolutely can't believe it. So they're awestruck right from the start. And then we have a building. It's about a 24 by 24 building, and we have the Iditarod Trail in the state of Alaska painted on the floor. We have all the checkpoints, and we basically just describe the Iditarod to the people and give them some insight of some strategies and how long it takes us to go from point to point and answer questions. And then we'll have an individual in the crowd we'll bring up behind the actual Iditarod racing sled of that year and stand behind the runner, and we'll explain how they're going to feel. Especially with the women, I like to have them up there because I'll tell them they won't need any Botox injections in their lips after a few days on the trail. Their lips kind of get puffed up and that kind of thing. And it makes it pretty fun and exciting.
You know, I always like to ask you guys that do these tours, what is some of the most obscure questions that you've ever had from these folks? Do you recall one of those memorable questions?
I have one for you here. Do dogs mate for life?
That's a good one. What was your answer for that one?
They're kind of like geese, you know. No, not really. that one floored me.
So when you have the tourists come up to your place and you take them for a ride, are you using a specially made motorized cart like some guys do? Or are you using only a dog-powered cart? What do you use for your tours?
Well, we have in the past, we had a special cart made that the dogs just pulled it. So it was a six-passenger cart, and I stood in the back and stood up and steered the thing. However, occasionally we'd have an individual that would fall out, and, of course, that's not very good. So this year we went ahead and purchased a Crew 6x6, a Polaris Ranger, that has six passengers in it, and we're going to try that out. So it has a little bit of motor to assist, and then, of course, a lot more stability to the whole experience. And then we'll be able to go on some different trails with that. Being that the dog-powered sole operation, we don't want to have the dogs pull too hard, you know. But they were pulling sometimes in the last, you know, several years of doing this up to 1,800 pounds. And so that's quite a load for them. So we want to try to lessen that up a little bit for them with the Ranger.
And what is the number of dogs you're hooking up to this cart or this Honda there?
It'll be 14 dogs.
You know, a lot of people are just amazed by that when they think, wow, 14 dogs can pull up to 1,800 pounds. And then they think, wow, my dog, I don't know if my dog can even carry a backpack. It is amazing how much these dogs can pull when they work together. Can you describe that a little bit for our listeners? We've never spoke about this, but about that capacity that each dog has and the weight that they can pull as their own, pulling their own weight, I guess.
Well, it's kind of controlled chaos, and that when we first take off, it's the anxiety level is high. We have to have everything set up, ready to go. You know, the dogs are so excited, we need to get out of the yard as quickly as we can, get the people loaded up, and get on their way, because these dogs are just absolutely insane about wanting to run. You know, we haven't ran now for a few weeks, and so. This morning with a nice cool temperature, the dogs are getting feisty and fired up and saying, run me, run me. So they know summer season's coming, and they love to pull equally as much in the summer as they do in the winter.
Right. Of course, it's not that 1,000 miles down the trail, but do you think the dogs have any idea when you're hooking up for that Iditarod there in Anchorage or Willow that they know what they're up against, or they just think it's just another training run?
No, there's when they start getting around a bunch of other dogs, they know. I think a lot of them know it's a race, and they can't wait to get down the trail and just keep going. And then we get into that schedule of running and resting, and the working dog of any type of work. You know, as everybody knows, a dog loves its work. So we just let them do their job and work, and then we're there to take care of their every small need. You know.
Right. So before we start talking about that Iditarod, I definitely want to give the folks that are listening, we have people listening all over the country, I'm sure. We're the only weekly mushing show on the radio, as far as I know. For people that are interested in these tours or coming up to visit you, is there a way that they can contact you, a website, phone number, whatever you want to offer?
Yeah, we have sundogkennel.com. It's on the website. Just type in dog mushing and sundog kennel. The term sundog kennel came from the rainbows around the sun, which is moisture in the high atmosphere. It's typically just before the storm, so we like to go mushing just before the storm, and it's just kind of a cool experience for us.
Very cool. We're talking to Jerry Souza, I believe. I don't want to mispronounce your name there. I did a Rod Musher, and he operates a tour operation up in Talkeetna. Talkeetna is what they call the gateway to Mount McKinley. It's about 2.5 hours, I guess it is, from Anchorage, and a heck of a lot of those tour buses make their way up the Parks Highway to Talkeetna. So let's talk about Iditarod, Jerry, if we can. I believe you finished 20th this year. Congratulations on that. Anything you want to start with when we start talking about this year's Iditarod?
Well, of course, with every race, the butterflies are just going crazy in the stomach. There's a lot of anxiety. The Iditarod is a place where dreams can be crushed. Everybody thinks they're going to have this great run and experience running the dogs and going to win the Iditarod kind of thing or do awfully darn well. And then reality sets in after 2 or 3 days, and we start to think, oh, my goodness, I made a mistake here, made a mistake there. So really it's more of trying to stay cautious and calm and just get out on the trail and work with the dogs and make sure that they're feeling the best they can feel as we're mushing along.
And finishing in 20th place is nothing to sneeze at. That is a very respectable position in the field of mushers that we have today. I have to congratulate you on that. What has been your best finish? And pardon my lack of knowledge here. In all of your Iditarods, what's the best finish you've had?
Well, we finished 16th there in 04.
So not bad there either. So, again, 20th place is definitely within the money, so to speak, as they say in Iditarod. And you had a heck of a bunch of excellent competition in front of and behind you. So, I think that you did pretty well. When you went into this year's race in terms of planning and preparation, when you set yourself up there in Willow that first Sunday of March, were you prepared as a team and as a musher for this year's race?
I believe we were, and part of course, our training was lacking in certain times of the season. We have trouble up here in Talkeetna of keeping the trail put in. We had just a tremendous amount of snow, and we're typically the only ones that break out the trail for ourselves to mush on. It's just, you know, to do 100-mile runs. There's a lot of people with the price of gas and working their jobs that just don't have, they're just not out traveling as much as they were, say, 10, 15 years ago. So we're the ones out there always finding new trail, making trail, putting trail in, and then, of course, snowing like this last winter all the time, it slowed down our training somewhat. With that being said, we entered into a couple of races, and one little race was the Don Bowers race. It's part of the Willow Winter Carnival. And it's a low-key race. There's not much money into it, but it's excellent training, I believe, for the dogs. It gives kind of a real experience of the race trail. And so we just do basically 50-mile runs on that race, and that kind of set them up for the next race. Because we were a little behind in training, the next race that we entered into was the Paul Johnson 450, which is a 450-mile race that ran from Unalakleet over to Caltag, back to Unalakleet, and then on up the coast to Nome following the Iditarod Trail. I think that run for us was absolutely paramount in our ability to both perform as well as we did and the dogs do as well as they did with that series of runs under their belt fairly close to Iditarod.
You know, I've heard a lot of talk about that Paul Johnson Memorial Race. Of course, it was the first year Paul Johnson passed away. Just this past year, he was Iditarod musher and passed away, I guess, unexpectedly. And so they started that race as a memorial to him. It took part during the Yukon Quest. So you had quite a few mushers that were taking part in that race, as well as several of them, you know, priming up for Iditarod or just doing the Yukon Quest during that time. What can you tell us about that race in terms of, you know, the trail, the competition that is entered? You know, I've heard a lot of people say that that's the race they want to go to next year, and, you know, they're going to rethink about doing others before or after that.
Yeah, it's an excellent race. Our first run, of course, from Unalakleet over to Caltag. The trail was a little bit punchy. We were the next to the last musher to leave on the trail. So we had the Portage racers, their 200-mile racers, go out ahead of us and then us. And then there was quite a bit of snowmobile traffic going back and forth. And, of course, that kind of just chewed up the trail. for us, it was perfect because all of our training this winter was basically soft trail, so it didn't bother the dogs any. It just took us longer to get over to Caltech. I think it took us about 3 hours longer than I think, say, Dee Dee Johnwell. I think she was the first musher out. She had good, hard pack trail all the way. So that first 90 miles set us back about 3 hours in the race. Now, we entered this race with the aspect of this thing as a training run for Iditarod. So when you go and enter in a race, you need to decide how are you going to run your race and try to stick to your plan and not get caught up in the hype of, well, I'm going to win the race kind of thing. Because if you know in your heart or, you know, in the bottom of your being that these dogs aren't quite ready for a big race like this, then it's best to use it as a training run. That's how we looked at it. So we gave them a good rest in Caltech and then came on back to Unalakleet and then ended up that time differential that we were behind. We stayed with the group, but we were several hours behind the front runners, and that was all at the cost of that first leg of the run. So with that being said, we did enter into some area there where there was a lot of overflow on the river going over to Koyuk, but they had trail breakers out there rerouting the trail for us and doing everything they could for the mushers. That community out there on the Bering Sea coast, they just love that dog sled race. I think it's going to be probably one of the most popular races in Alaska, except for maybe, like, say, the Iditarod or the Yukon Quest. But pretty good money in the race to pay for your expenses if you do fairly well. And, of course, they really take care of you, good veterinary care and the checkpoints, and the people are excited to see you. And it's just really, really an exciting time to be out there.
If we could, Jerry, can we spend a little bit of time? You mentioned that schedule that every musher keeps. A lot of fans don't know a lot about that. They think that, you know, you just hook up your dogs and you've trained for it all year and you're off to the races, so to speak. And they don't quite understand that there, to most mushers, there's a really hard set plan of what you're going to do, whether it be a run rest schedule or what you're going to do from this checkpoint to that checkpoint. Can you describe that for us a little bit? Being a 12-year veteran now of multiple races, of course, of the Iditarod, tell us a little bit about that trail schedule, if you can.
Well, typically, a good rule of thumb is a six-hour run and a six-hour rest schedule. So 24/7, you want to try to rest those dogs in the heat of the day, which would be noon to 6 p.m., which will set you up for a 6 p.m. to midnight. And then, of course, nothing much happens that's good for anybody after midnight. You rest them from midnight to 6 a.m. and then run from 6 a.m. back to noon again. Now, we vary the schedule after we get into the race a little bit, but we always try to maintain that we'll get back on that rest in the heat of the day between that noon and 6 p.m. mark.
And again, this is for the fans, but why don't you run during the day?
We do run in the day later in the race, but every opportunity, of course, is for better care for the dogs. So in the heat of the day, which can be in the sun, 45 degrees or more, or it could be 20 below, but in either case, it's going to be most beneficial for the dogs to be able to stretch out on that straw and the blankets over them and dog coats to get that needed rest that they work so hard for. And then, of course, in the evening, dogs just typically tend to want to perk up, and I think they run harder and faster in the evening, in the night. My personal philosophy is on it that the dog's mind's eye, so to speak, they just simply cannot see as far down the trail as if they could in the broad daylight. So they get a little better performance without asking them to. They just want to. And so we try to let them run at their peak time.
Well, Jerry, we have about 5 minutes left here on our show today, but I'd like to stay with this if we can for just a second. Lance Mackey mentioned one time that the way that he prepares himself for these multi-night runs, staying up late and, you know, doing that whole musher thing, is he reads by candlelight with the heater full blast in his house. How do you prepare for these grueling days on the Iditarod Trail as a musher, as a human, versus the dogs?
Well, we try to train in the winter for those experiences, and then before the race, I try to get as much sleep as I can. It's sort of like the Wild West tales and the stories when when the cowboys would go across the desert, and I think I read one where it was some people would say, well, go without water for as long as you can and then cross the desert. Well, the smart individual would drink as much water as he could and take as much water to make that crossing and come out of the other side. So with us, I think the same way with sleep deprivation. We know what we're going to get ourselves into. Try to get as much rest as you can before that event. And then when we're doing our chores with the dogs, we try to be as efficient as possible and give them the care they need and then try to get to sleep right away so that, you know, a person we can adjust to a 2 or 3 hours rest every time we stop, and that's almost enough rest to get down the trail.
And how long does – I know you're in your early 50s, so we don't want to say that you're too young or too old, of course, for this, but how long does it take you to recover from this after you get home in terms of sleep and catching up to where your body feels right?
For me, it seems like about a month.
Wow.
Seems like a long time. It may be just only a week or two, but typically, like this year, we just get run down. You get sick, you get a cold, you get, you know, the flu or something. Because our system has just run down, and then we're tired. And so, I mean, after 2 or 3 days, we're kind of up and walking around. But when I get back home, I just kind of am lethargic for a while, and then it kind of springs back over a little bit of time.
Very cool. Jerry, we have about 3 minutes left. Anything else you want to mention, a story you might want to tell before we close the show?
Well, this year we were mushing up the trail, and I got to the top of the Blueberry Hills, which is outside of Unalakleet, and looking down into the Bering Sea. And I could see from experience that it was white, blowing snow, but it looked like a foggy white, like a painting or something. And so we stopped the team, and a musher came up behind me and asked me what I was doing. And I said, well, I'm putting on everything I own. That's a blizzard down there. So we stopped and put the coats on every dog and buttoned them all up, make sure they're all well-adjusted, and put all the clothes that we had available in our sled, put all that on, and then took off down the trail. And individual that passed me got into Shaq Tulik and goes, boy, I sure wish I'd have listened to you because I froze my tail end off. So we got in there, and there was a whole pile of teams up there in Shaq Tulik. The storm had set in pretty strong, and we went ahead and gave the dogs their rest, and the trail was blown shut. The markers were down. We got up early the next morning, walked out, we could see a few markers out there on the ice. We just went ahead and took a look-see. The dogs had eaten very well. They drank all their water and their broth, and so their tanks were full, and I decided, boy, now's my chance. I should just try to get on out there, you know. So the checkers there assisted us with getting the team to the point where we could depart, going across the ice. And I had 2 leaders up front, but one of them wasn't going to have anything to do with that strong wind. She came back a couple times, so I just took her out of the team and put her back in the main team portion and had a single leader out there, and she just stood right there on point, right into the wind as if she loved it. And so I told the guys, I go, man, I don't know how this is going to work. We'll see what we can do. And I go, well, your leader's out there pretty good. You might do okay. So we pulled the hook. They took right off, and down the trail we went. So we got across over to Koyuk, and we'd managed to get a 6-hour jump on all the rest of our competition there. And that's pretty much how we ended up getting into that top 20 spot. So at that point, after that, we could see that we really couldn't gain a whole lot of anybody else ahead of us. So we just gave the dogs extra rest at the checkpoints where we could, and just to make sure we had a good cushion when we got into White Mountain, which would be about an hour and a half, and that would secure our position coming into Nome. So it was a good race, and we had a lot of fun.
Very cool. Jerry Souza on the show tonight, sundogkennel.com if you're interested in finding out more about his tours and his operation up there in Talkeetna. Jerry, we're about out of time. I want to, thank you very much for being on, and congratulations with your high place this year and this year's Iditarod. We hope to see you out there on the trail next year, okay?
Yep, sounds good. And we just want to thank all the volunteers and participants in the Iditarod for making Iditarod the last great race. You know, without the Iditarod, there wouldn't be the sled dog popularity, I believe, as there is today. So thanks again to Iditarod.
Very good. Thank you very much. We'll talk again soon. Okay, Jerry?
Okay, bye.
Thanks. Goodbye. This is Robert Forto on behalf of Mushing Radio. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.